A reading from the book of Job. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. He stretches out Zaphon over the void, and hangs the earth upon nothing. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not torn open by them. He covers the face of the full moon and spreads over it his cloud. He has described a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. By his power he stilled the sea. By his understanding he struck down Rahab. By his wind the heavens were made fair. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. These are indeed but the outskirts of his ways, and how small a whisper do we hear of him, but the thunder of his power. Who can understand? Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged Jesus repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So Jesus went with him. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She'd endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately, her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before Jesus and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Jesus took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha, come," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. The Gospel of Christ.
Before we get into the sermon proper today, I need to make a little bit of a corrective to last week's sermon. Nothing major, but it's just the principle of the thing. Ever since we started walking our way through the Gospel of Mark, we had said that we were going to let Mark speak for itself, and so we weren't going to draw from Matthew and Luke and John to help fill out the story in Mark. But last week, we talked about how Mark said that Jesus used the parables in order to confuse people or to make that difficult for them to understand. And I had taken issue with that and said, look, you know, how much clearer can the parable of the Good Samaritan be, you know, like everybody gets what that's about. The problem is the parable of the Good Samaritan is not in the Gospel of Mark, it's in the Gospel of Luke. So what I should have said in the interest of maintaining consistency is Jesus used the one known as the parable of the wicked tenants, which comes up in the Gospel of Mark. which was directed against the religious leaders, and the religious leaders totally got it when Jesus told that parable. So the point remains the same. Jesus is using his parables to illustrate and to bring to light things, and this addition that Mark was saying that he did it in order to keep people in the dark is really a challenging thing to uphold. So that's the correction for last week's sermon. But for this week, we are going to move into Mark chapter 5, and you might be expecting that this sermon is going to be about those two things that we read that Jesus had done, healing Jairus' daughter, in fact, raising her up from the dead, and healing the woman with the hemorrhage for 12 years. But actually, I'm not going to talk about that. We only really needed one verse from the gospel for what I want to talk about today, and it's the first verse of the passage that said this: when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. That's what I want to zero in on, because it's interesting to see as you read the first 8 chapters of Mark, and if you're, you know, just paying attention to patterns and stuff like that, what you discover is in the first 8 chapters, the first half of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is up in the northern part of Israel, and you will see these references made often, that he was by the sea, that he was next to the sea. In fact, you're going to find out that he crosses the sea 5 times in those 8 chapters. This is something that Mark keeps emphasizing, the sea, the sea, the sea. Now, what makes that interesting is when we do compare, you know, this is what Mark is saying, and then we do say, I wonder what Matthew does with that or what Luke does with that. Even when Matthew and Luke take the same episode of Jesus' life that they're describing, they tend to either eliminate or just minimize the reference to the sea. They don't bother bringing it up. And when you think about it too, even with the 2 stories, or this one large story with 2 episodes in it that we read today, when it opens up by saying that there was this great crowd and he was by the sea, and then Jairus comes to him to plead for his daughter and the woman with the hemorrhage comes to touch him, it's irrelevant that he's next to the water. Like, that has nothing to do with what it is that took place. So it makes you wonder, why is Mark bringing this up? Why does he bother making a point that he's at the sea? Now, what sea is he talking about? Well, this is the Sea of Galilee. If you can imagine Israel here, the Mediterranean Sea is on the west. And then as you come inward, Jerusalem is down here. And just to the east and north of it is the Dead Sea. It's connected by the Jordan River up to the Sea of Galilee, which is in the northern part of the country. And this is where Jesus spends the first half of the gospel. After chapter 9, he'll then make his way down south into Jerusalem, and that's where the crucifixion happens and all of this, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. So Jesus is up here in the north, and the Sea of Galilee is right plunk in the middle of this region. On one side, on the west side, is Jewish territory, and on the east side is Gentile territory, a region known as the Decapolis, or the region of 10 cities. And so the Sea of Galilee itself is quite large. I mean, technically it's a freshwater lake, but it was referred to as a sea because of how big it is. It's about 13 kilometers across, 21 kilometers long, 166 square kilometers in area, if you want to do the math. And just by way of reference, the city of Lethbridge is 127 square kilometers. So the Sea of Galilee, even though it's a freshwater lake, is not small. I mean, it's not as big as the Great Lakes or anything, but it's a sizable piece of water. You couldn't just swim across it. You need a boat. It's big enough for there to be winds and storms and that kind of thing. So this is a significant body of water, and Jesus does things around it all the time in the Gospel of Mark, and Mark keeps pointing that out. So again, we have to wonder, why is Mark saying, oh, by the way, he happened to be by the sea? Now I'm going to tell you something about him that completely doesn't matter about the water. Or does it? One of the things we have to keep in mind is when it comes to ancient writings back then, you couldn't just go to Staples and buy a ream of paper and a Bic pen and write things down. They used papyrus, which was a reed-like plant that you would pound out so it could be flattened out, and then you could use this surface to write on. And of course, you had to make an ink and use a quill or something to write on it. Eventually, it gets replaced by parchment, which is a way of treating an animal hide in order to make that something you can write on. But in both cases, Getting a hold of papyrus and the ink to write on it, getting a hold of parchment and the ink to write on it, is not easy. It's not cheap. You don't want to waste ink and papyrus writing things down that are irrelevant. So that tells us there has to be a reason why Mark would make this point. Why does he keep bringing up that Jesus is by the sea? Why does he narrate that he crosses the Sea of Galilee 5 times? Well, one reason, and I think this is probably what's really happening with Mark, is in the ancient Near East, in the ancient Middle East, going back to ancient Israel and the Hebrew Bible, even before that to Egyptian mythology, looking at the Sumerians and the Akkadians that were in the area beforehand, the sea represented chaos, represented danger. It represented the things that are of great concern. And there would be stories told that the sea itself was a god or a goddess that had to be defeated. In fact, the earlier creation stories before the ones we find in the Bible would talk about how the sea had to be subdued in order for creation to happen. And even in the first creation story in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, it talks about how the earth was formless and empty and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. That the planet was just this ball of water and God had to create land on the third day, it says in Genesis chapter 1. In order to bring about what we live on. The sea was a source of problem, chaos, concern, danger, and even in ancient thinking, was a deity that had to be defeated. So with that thought in mind, and this is what people are generally thinking, we can start to get a better picture of what Mark might be doing with these comments. Let's not forget that this image of the desperate nature of the sea continues on for some time. As we get into the medieval era and onwards into the Renaissance, when we have people exploring the world more and they're on their ships and they're sailing around and they're making maps, you might well recall that many of these old maps, when you get to the edge of them, where this is as far as they've navigated and they haven't got any further, what you usually see written down at the edge of the sea is, "Here be dragons," right? Because they hadn't been there yet. It's scary. Maybe they had heard that a ship had been destroyed by a whale. And of course, if you'd never seen a sperm whale before or a blue whale, you have this huge creature. And yeah, that sounds like a dragon to me, right? Like this idea is the sea is a scary place. And even today, with, of course, our much more scientific view of the sea, we understand that, you know, there's no sea monsters in there. Yeah, there are big creatures, but there's not some kind of entity there that is just seeking to devour us or something. But we'll still think twice before sailing across the North Atlantic in the winter. And if a hurricane spools up in the Atlantic Ocean or a cyclone spools up in the Pacific Ocean, we're going to make sure we give it wide berth. Even the strongest military ships are not going to sail into that kind of storm because of the power that it brings about. But there's nothing amazing about it. We understand there's these convection currents in the air and the water temperature changes and so on causes the storm to emerge, and that's what brings the energy into the water and creates the great waves. But we're still going to be mindful of the sea. And of course, even thinking of our Anglican heritage, we're going to be singing our last song, our recessional hymn today, that's going to talk about those in peril on the seas. Because, of course, the British Empire was all about having the British Navy that went everywhere, and the concern about the sea was always very huge. Two more things just to help drive this point home. We read about it in our first reading, Job chapter 26, which is taking an ancient concept of how the gods worked. And it says that, speaking of the God that Job is worshiping, by his power he stilled the sea. And here sea has a capital S to indicate it's been personified. By his power he stilled the sea. By his understanding he struck down Rahab. And Rahab was one of the names of a goddess of the sea that was in use at the time. So here we're saying that God has brought about control of this sea. And then even with our psalm today, in Psalm 77, King David, if this is one of the ones that he wrote, said in verse 16, "The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you and trembled, the very depths were shaken." And so the sea is personified, the sea represents danger, it represents chaos, it represents challenge. And Jesus does pretty much everything he does in the Gospel of Mark by the sea. The sea has no bearing on what Jesus does. And of course, as we found at the beginning of the gospel, Mark's point is to say that Jesus is the Son of God, right? That's what he said. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so now, people who are reading his gospel, which he had written at least 35 years after the life of Jesus, so anybody who is reading the gospel of Mark in all likelihood has never met Jesus, has never seen Jesus, has never heard Jesus' voice, has no idea what he looks like. All they're going to know about Jesus is what they're reading that Mark has to say, and Mark is going to point out that Jesus is the Son of God. And so he does all sorts of amazing things. He casts out demons, he heals people from sickness, he multiplies loaves of bread, and he does all sorts of amazing things. And he also does it without worrying about the sea. In fact, he crosses it 5 times. No big deal. On 2 of those occasions, there's a storm. So the first time they're crossing the sea, by the way, they're going from the Jewish side to the Gentile side, which is interesting. And what you'll see often is what Jesus does on the Jewish side, he ends up doing the same kind of thing on the Gentile side. So in chapter 1, we find out that he casts out some demons, and the word about his great power spreads all over the place. Then he crosses over to the other side, and the first thing he does is he casts out a man with a whole bunch of demons in him, and then word spreads all around the Decapolis about Jesus. Then he comes back to the other side. Then he feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And then he crosses over to the other side and feeds 4,000 people with 7 loaves of bread and a few other fish that people usually forget about. But he's mirroring his activity on both the Jewish side of the Sea of Galilee and the Gentile side. So that's saying something too. But just coming back to the sea itself, the first time he's crossing, they're on the boat, they're going across, Jesus goes to sleep. And then a great storm winds up, and these fishermen are afraid for their lives because they're caught in the middle of this storm, and they have to wake Jesus up to say, "Don't you care that we're going to drown?" He's going, "What's the big deal? Peace, be still." And then the sea and the waves are calm. And the people are amazed, and they're saying, the disciples are saying, "Who is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" This is the point that Mark is trying to draw, that the power of the sea is irrelevant to Jesus. In the third crossing, Jesus sends the disciples to go across to Bethsaida, which is on the other side. He stays on land, goes up to a mountain to pray, and then after a while, he looks down in the sea and sees that there's a storm and they're straining at the oars, so he goes out and walks on the water as though he was going to pass them by. They see him, they're completely freaked out. He says, "Don't be afraid, it is I." He gets into the boat, the sea gets calm again, and everything's just fine. And then he redirects them to go to Gennesaret instead. But the point is, for Jesus in the Gospel of Mark, the threat of the sea is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter to him. It's just a non-issue. Now, for us today, 2,000 years removed from the ancient thinking of the peoples back then, as I said before, with our scientific perspective, we don't think of the sea as being an entity. There's no god or goddess of the sea. That's nothing that we have to concern ourselves with. But the metaphor, the concern about the danger the sea presents is still there. And we're certainly not talking about being careless about anything. The reality is you can't breathe water. So if you try, you're going to drown. So, you know, we're mindful of what the sea is. But what we can do is draw from this metaphor the idea that what Mark is saying is when it comes to when it comes to dealing with what Jesus has to say and what Jesus demonstrates and what Jesus represents, there is no reason for us to fear the chaos and danger and uncertainty that is part of our lives. How many of us feel that we really have everything in control? How many of us feel that we're just, "Yeah, I know exactly what's happening with life. It's like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do the rest of the day today, and everything's going to be fine. This is what I'm going to do tomorrow when everything is fine." No, that's not what happens. We never really know what's going to happen on a given day. There can always be some uncertainty. There can always be some danger. There can always be something coming upon us that we aren't expecting. A number of us here in our congregation have been dealing with sicknesses. You know, Godfrey Mansfield from our 8 o'clock service had to, you know, get a stent put in unexpectedly. All of a sudden, he has a heart condition. He has to go to the hospital for that. And Jason's been battling sickness. And I had COVID at the beginning of November. And, you know, all of these things happen. Reverend Margaret, by the way, is going to be getting knee surgery done on Wednesday, which is why she's not with us today. She's just making sure that she doesn't catch anything to give reason for her not to have her procedure on Wednesday, right? Like, so we're doing all of these things aware that anything could happen. And if we allow the concern about the chaos of life or the worries about what might happen or the uncertainty of what's around the corner or even we have an annual meeting coming up, facing the challenges of the budget for the next year, you know, we can be paralyzed by fear and concern. And we need not be. And in this gospel, Mark is saying that what Jesus had to offer is something that can cause us to put aside the fears of the chaos and the uncertainty. It's not a denial of the reality. There really are storms that happen. You have to be mindful of things. But we can take what it is that we see in Jesus and find in it a confidence that we can face the various challenges that life throws at us and have reason to feel that we do not have to be worried about it. We pay attention, but we say, you know what? As I look at how Jesus approached life, as I look at the things Jesus had to say, the teachings he gave, the approach he takes, if I take that on board in my own life and trust that there's something to that, we can find ourselves facing these challenges in a far more confident way than if we were just left on our own to go, I hope this works out okay. We can instead face the uncertainty and say, all right, what did Jesus do? He was always acknowledging God the Father. He was always acknowledging the one who has given him life, who he's representing, who he's encouraging. You know, Jesus would do things, people would glorify God. He's always pointing to God. How can we take that on board as well? What kind of chaos are you facing now? What kind of uncertainty are you facing in your life? Is it paralyzing you with fear or concern or question? I'm not going to suggest for a second that you just pretend it isn't there, but instead to take on board this idea that Jesus is showing us that we can face these things without being fearful, but instead with confidence, head them off at the pass, dive into it and say, all right, God is with me. Let us take this on and trust that things will work as best as they can, and I do not need to be fearful as I carry on in life. Amen.